True Crime Fest Northwest is just a few weeks away, and you can get your tickets now at truecrimefestnorthwest.com. What can you expect from the inaugural event? On Friday, August 30th, attendees can check out the Expo Hall before enjoying a kickoff presentation and self-defense training from Rose City Self-Defense. On Saturday, you'll have another chance to get swag from your favorite podcasters and true crime creators in the Expo Hall. Presentations on Saturday include, but are not limited to, Desiree Young, who is Kyron Horman's mother, United Justice Group, which is family members of victims of accused serial killer Jesse Calhoun, our friends Sisters in Survival, a.k.a. Tiffany Edens and Danielle Tudor, the National Center for Victims of Crime, authors Lindsay Wade and Rebecca Morris, and some of your favorite podcasts like PNW Haunts and Homicides, A Hateful Homicide, Somewhere in the Pines, Snake River Killer, and of course, Murder in the Rain, among others. And those are just some of the scheduled appearances. Saturday night will also be the time for the VIP party. Sunday, the festivities continue with presentations, a drag bingo raffle fundraiser, and a VIP brunch. So get to truecrimefestnorthwest.com, use code RAIN10 for 10% off, and get your tickets today. And vendors, there's still time to sign up for a table. Visit truecrimefestnorthwest.com and get your tickets now.
True Crime Fest Northwest, True Crime Fest Northwest, True Crime Fest Northwest, True Crime Fest Northwest.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. As Rob Thomas iconically said in the classic summer jam Smooth, man, it's a hot one. This summer has seen record temps across the country. Speaking of across the country, we are once again headed out of town, hosting a booth and presentation at the True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival in Denver. It starts this Friday, July 12th, and you can still get tickets at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. Since we're out and about, we're sharing one of my favorite Patreon episodes, Nine Strangers. Not only is it a fascinating mystery surrounding the deaths of two mountain climbers in South America, but we hope it will chill you out with talks of elevation, snow, and freezing temperatures. So what happens when nine strangers set out from across the U.S. after a Portland-based climbing group puts together the climb of a lifetime? Elevation sickness, frustration, and eventually suspicious deaths. Along with most of the U.S. in the last couple of weeks, Josh and I were not so much iced in, but frozen in for the weekend. To embrace the negative 12-degree wind chill and 52-mile-per-hour gusts of wind, we chose some seasonal favorites to watch. We started the new season of True Detective, set in the fictional yet freezing town of Ennis, Alaska. We also watched some of season 5 of Fargo and Josh's fave, The Thing. We then breezed through the 2.5-hour retelling of the Uruguayan rugby team whose plane crashed in the Andes and was first on the big screen in one of Emily's faves, the 1993 film Alive.
Oh, yeah. And I can't wait to watch the new
remake. I don't know how you haven't. I would watch it every day.
I almost did the other night, but I was so tired I didn't want to do two sittings.
That's fair.
Maybe today is the day.
Oh, I hope so. The new version called Society of the Snow is on Netflix now and is incredible. Josh and I highly recommend it.
That's true. Alive is one of my favorite movies, and this is a better version of that.
Agreed.
I love that we have all the same favorite movies. Like, I can predict if Josh is going to like something.
I was so excited when Alive was coming out. I remember seeing the trailer for the first time, and it's John Malkovich playing one of the survivors
He does the, like, recap. He's, like, the main narrator.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I watched it every time it played on TV.
Yeah.
I mean, I never got sick. There was one weekend it played like 3 times and I watched it.
I think that's where a lot of my Ethan Hawke love comes from.
Oh, yeah.
He's my favorite.
And isn't like Bon Jovi in it or something?
There's a guy that looks like
Bon Jovi. Looks like him. Yeah, and I always thought it was Bon Jovi. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that movie.
Keeping with that theme, I wanted to write a bonus episode with a wintry tone. That's when I remembered a friend, hey, Carrie, thanks for the recommendation, who mentioned an article while we chatted at a holiday party back in September. I found the article and decided between the mystery, Oregon connection, and still unanswered questions regarding two deaths that this was the story to tell. Thanks to climate change, Mother Nature is revealing her once darkest secrets. Personal items and even bodies are no longer tucked away due to melting glaciers and receding waters, something I talked about at length in my Lake Mead episode. One such item that recently came to the surface was a camera that had been packed in ice and snow for 50 years on a mountain in South America, a camera that many had hoped would answer questions to a mystery long left unsolved. The film inside didn't reveal anything spectacular, so the mystery and legends remain. Before getting into the story, I need to give some appreciation to John Branch at the New York Times. No, this is not an endorsement for the New York Times as a whole, but just for John's article. I don't often focus on one main source, but John conducted so many interviews, he went through all of the documentation, and even went to Argentina several times to create an incredibly comprehensive article about the story. I did use other sources for the little details, but I cannot recommend his article, Ghosts on the Glacier, enough. There are beautiful photos, videos, interviews, and diagrams of the mountain in question, so be sure to check that out. Since first being traversed by an expedition in 1934 by a group from Poland, the Polish Glacier, part of the Aconcagua Mountain, has claimed 153 lives. Of those, two deaths remain the most talked and debated about. Mountain climbing as a sport began in the mid-1800s. After gaining popularity in Europe, the U.S. hopped on the trend and soon alpine clubs formed. In Oregon in 1894, the Mazamas became the third such club in the state and is still functioning today. The goals of the group are to explore snow-capped peaks and mountains, collect scientific knowledge about the environment, preserve the natural beauty of the forests and mountains, and to share the knowledge they gain throughout the Pacific Northwest. The hope is to inspire everyone to love and protect the mountains. You can learn all about the group or even join it at mazamas.org. That's mazamas.org. It was through this club a fateful trip was planned. The group of eight climbers and two guides that would find themselves at the base of the Aconcagua consisted of 38-year-old Miguel Alfonso, the local guide, 25-year-old Roberto Bustos, the manager of the base camp, Carmi Defoe, 52, a lawyer and leader of the Mazamas group, Jim Petrosky, 39, a psychiatrist from Portland, Bill Eubank, 45, a physician from Kansas City, Arnold McMillan, 46, a dairy farmer out of Otis, Oregon, Bill Zeller, 45, an Oregon State Police officer from Salem, John Shelton, 25, a student at BYU, John Cooper, a 35-year-old surface operations engineer working in mission control for NASA, and Janet Johnson, 36, a librarian from Denver who had a PhD in education. Before I get to their story, we need to first discuss the mountain. Aconcagua is one of the seven summits. The seven summits represent the highest peak on each continent. In order from lowest to highest peak, there is Kosciuszko in Australia, Mount Blanc in Europe, Venison in Antarctica, Kilimanjaro in Africa, Denali in North America, Aconcagua in South America, and Everest in Asia, making Aconcagua the second highest and the highest in the Americas. Note, there are varying lists on the mountains and even lists of eight or nine, depending on where one counts invisible borders. So there are a few other incredibly high peaks, but for this story, we're staying with the seven for a reason, which we'll get to. Many climbers are fans of Aconcagua because on the north side, it's considered an easy climb, a term many misconstrue to mean you don't need any experience, and they end up meeting their demise. Although the north side, with far less snow, no glacier, and an easier route, doesn't require climbing equipment to summit the peak, it still claims lives, including five climbers in January of 2009. The mountain itself is located in Argentina, about halfway between the Argentinian city of Mendoza and Santiago, Chile. Or, for those of you here in the Northwest, it is 10,174 kilometers or 6,321 miles from Portland. Though the north side presents fewer problems, more experienced climbers prefer to take the Polish route. A memo sent out from the Mazamas group in the early 70s regarding the climb of the Polish route said, Difficulties are said to be moderate, a couple of places where we'll want handlines, not any more difficult than the normal route on Mount McKinley, which also goes by Denali. McKinley being the summit in Alaska that was featured on the list of seven. And now the climbers. That memo was sent out to those who were signed up to receive the newsletter as members of the climbing group. They were also invited to join on an expedition in South America with a deposit of $50. By June, the list of those interested was compiled and the team was assembled. Jim, the psych from Portland, would be the deputy leader of the group. Bill, the doctor, would be the doctor. John, the college student, was not only a geologist, but he spoke Spanish thanks to his recent mission. Though there were some nerves about the heft of the mission and the lack of experience between the climbers, they proceeded. They didn't know this was going to be much more exerting than their usual weekend outings. 2 months before the climb was set to take place, an eighth and final member joined the team, librarian and educator Janet. She would be the only female in the group. Of course, this did not mean that she had any less experience than the boys in the club. Janet had been adopted, and when she was 10 years old, she asked her parents if she could have a sister, so they adopted 5-year-old Judy. Judy was interviewed for the article, where she spoke about how intelligent Janet was and that if she had been able to, she would have spent every moment on a mountain. There was a peace she found in the isolation. It's believed her peace-seeking was also part defiance. Defiance toward her mother, who had not so much disowned her for being gay, but definitely took issue with it. When she discovered letters between Janet and another young woman, Janet was sent to a hospital so she could be cured. So perhaps that defiance was what helped Janet break records and reach literally new peaks. At 30 years old, she was one of the first 20 women to climb the 14ers. What are the 14ers? Why, that's the more than 50 peaks in Colorado that are higher than 14,000 feet in elevation. So, you know, just some casual climbing. She had been on climbs in Peru. She had checked Kilimanjaro off the list. She climbed Iztaccíhuatl in Mexico City, a mountain over 17,000 feet. And she had already touched the top of Mount Fuji, Mount Blanc, and the Matterhorn. The number of peaks she summited is unknown and perhaps even uncountable. In addition to climbing, she would spend her summers kayaking or even hanging around Mount Hood. Janet's plan for the trip after Argentina was to go to Alaska to conquer Denali. All this to say, she was far from inexperienced. Packing for the trip, she brought along a sleeping bag, glasses, mittens, a red down jacket, flannels, and boots. She also brought a Nikon Nikomat camera. Before leaving, she used a label maker to mark the bottom of her camera with a blue label embossed with her name and address. Not long before the mission to the peak, John Cooper was working on a mission to the moon. He was the guy talking to the astronauts as they operated the lunar module. Adventure like that wasn't new for John. He had been in the Coast Guard, was a smoke jumper for the Forest Service, was a deep sea diver, and a pilot. Climbing wasn't new to John either. He too had gone to incredible summits such as Popocatépetl in Mexico, Mount Kenya, and Kilimanjaro. When it was time to leave for the climb in 73, he was married and had a 4-year-old son. And now the climb. It was January 12, 1973, when John met up with Janet in Miami, where their flights from Houston and Denver, respectively, landed. From there, they boarded the same flight to Argentina. News of the planned summit had been somewhat covered in the States, but it was the Argentina newspapers that were really thrilled to cover the story. The story of 8 Americans off to conquer the continent's highest peak was exciting, but it wasn't just the climb that had piqued people's interest. The cast of characters was like something out of The Village People or a Halloween party. There was the doctor, lawyer, psychiatrist, cop, a student, NASA scientist, and Janet, the woman. All the elements of an interesting story were in place. For Rafael Moran, the reporter who covered the story, there was something more. He had a nagging feeling in his gut as he spoke to the group after they landed in Argentina, which led to Rafael leaning over to his photographer to say, "Take each of their photos today. I don't think they're all coming back."
Jeez.
Yeah, trust that gut. This inkling was based on the energy of the group. While they had all arrived together thanks to the climbing club, they did not know each other. They were not a team. And that lack of camaraderie was what Rafael was sensing. He also felt they were approaching the mountain as just another climb. He felt their improvisational approach to climbing the second highest mountain after Everest was going to be costly. 8 days later, on January 20th, the team gathered at the bottom of the mountain and started the excruciating hike. Using mules to carry their supplies and aid them across water, the group of 10 left their starting point and walked 25 miles. At the end of that journey, they stayed in a stone house surrounded by what John would say in his diary was stark beauty, where the earth was baked hard as concrete. Then the first of many issues. They hadn't even gotten to the base camp yet, and Bill the doctor was sick. At the end of the following day's hike, yes, it took them 2 days just to get to the base camp, they were finally there, which sat in a valley at the base of the mountain. A space that has, because of climbing tourism, become a buzzing hive of adventure seekers, much different than when these few brave souls were the only ones attempting to do so in that season. Local man Miguel Alfonso had been hired as a guide, mostly due to his experience of summiting Acawanga 5 times. In the end, he wasn't used as much more than a human map for the Americans to reference when they needed. They didn't look to him for advice or recommendations on how to traverse the difficult terrain. Miguel hired Roberto, the 25-year-old local man who was going to be in charge of the base camp. He was impressed with the high-quality equipment brought by the group, but just like the journalist, he too noticed a lack of a team mentality, saying later, "There was no group attitude. I was thinking, oh, I am on my own. Everyone has to take care of himself." In my opinion, they weren't ready for such a strange and big mountain as Acawanga. For those like myself who know what they know of mountain climbing only from the movies and those annoying guys you've gone on Tinder dates with, there is so much more to it than just walking up the mountain. This trip would require multiple trips just to get the gear up the mountain. So on day one, they left the base camp and started up to camp one. They took supplies and used the climb as an opportunity to adjust to the elevation, which they would need to do as they were standing at 15,500 feet, which is 1,006 feet higher than Mount Whitney, the highest point in the continental United States. After dropping those supplies, they went back down to the base. The next trip up to Camp 2 took 7 hours and went up 3,000 more feet in elevation. Besides the elevation and hiking, other elements made the trek unbearable, such as scree, those walls of sliding rocks that are not only difficult to walk on, but are incredibly sharp. One touch can turn your hand into hamburger. Another major and literal obstacle were the fields of penitence. Penitence look like a mix of stalagmites, crystals, and coral reefs. The pillars of white are caused by solar radiation. After reading about them and being very barely educated in them, I can explain them like this. So, you know those news broadcasts when it's freezing cold out and the reporters have to go throw water in the air to show how fast it freezes? Mm-hmm. It's kind of that idea. So, basically, the sun is hitting these piles of snow and ice, and as it's evaporating, it starts to freeze at the same time. Literally frozen in time, the process of evaporation. The towers appear to grow out of the earth, trying to reach the sun. Some are spread apart, and some are in condensed groupings. And even though they're just snow and ice, they are immovable and sharp. They can be as short as a couple of centimeters or as tall as 16 feet. The team was dealing with tight groups of pillars that were standing 6 feet tall. These were some of the hardest areas for them to get through because they don't move. You can't break them. There's no movement to them. They might as well be stone. Fun fact related to NASA, it's believed Jupiter's moon Europa is home to penitents nearly 50 feet tall, and Pluto might be home to some that are hundreds of feet tall. During these first few days, Bill the cop was the hero, not only making water runs, but carrying 80 pounds of gear to the first camp, which was far more than his own share. According to John the scientist, who kept a detailed diary of the trip, it was Janet who was not only lacking in the helping department, but she struggled socially. Before leaving, John said Janet had, quote, nothing feminine about her. As an example of her perceived extreme behavior, John wrote about when they were still at the hotel before leaving for the mountain, and he clutched his pearls as Janet went swimming, only in her shirt, bra, and panties, and, quote, the pool was full of people. On this day of the climb, he said about Janet, she is a real loner and appears to be for only one thing, to get herself to the summit, at the expense of everyone or on everyone's back. So is this because she was actually self-centered, or was it because it was the early 70s and having a woman on the expedition maybe was unusual and made the men feel uncomfortable? Was it because she was gay? Were they misreading her need to stay separate for perhaps her own safety? Which I think almost any woman traveling with a group of eight strangers would probably keep herself a little separate. So there's no telling, but I certainly take his entries with a grain of salt because that's just his perception. Before getting too far into the trip, one of the youngest members, 25-year-old college student and the trip's interpreter, John Shelton, was a victim of altitude sickness. He was the first, but would not be the last member of the team to have to go back before reaching the peak. The next day, Bill, the sick doctor, and team leader Carmi also had to turn back. Getting adjusted to the elements, the remaining climbers went to Camp 3. This was at the base of what was known as the Polish Glacier. They were now at 19,400 feet. They were appreciative of a day off from climbing the next day, but they did have to sit through a storm to get it. Camp 3 was the last stopping point before the summit at 22,831 feet. From where they were, at the bottom of the glacier, they found ideal conditions for their gear and a climb. They expected that it would take at least the following day to get up there, but they weren't expecting it to be too arduous. As the team, probably nervously and excitedly, wrapped up their breakfast and prepared to summit the mountain, Jim, the psychologist from Portland, struggled to get his crampon on his shoes. Crampons are those little metal attachments you put on your climbing shoes.
Oh, I thought you meant get his cramp on.
Like having cramps?
I'm climbing and I got a leg cramp.
Oh, or a lady. I'm getting my cramps on.
I have those right now.
Oh, I'm sorry. So crampons resemble cleats, kind of, and they're meant to help with grip and traction, especially in ice. Everyone stopped to monitor him, and they realized that he was possibly dealing with high-altitude cerebral edema.
Oh, no.
It's a type of mountain sickness that is brought on by leaking capillaries in the brain. This can lead to deadly brain swelling. Because of this, Alfonso had to take Jim back to the base. This left NASA John, Librarian Janet, Officer Bill, and Oregon Dairy Farmer Arnold alone on the mountain without their local guide, team leader, second-in-command, translator, or doctor.
Hey, everybody, I think we should go back to our lives. This is not happening.
Everyone's saying this isn't working.
What were we just watching where it
we
was
We watched
like...
Below Deck last
oh,
night.
Oh, yes.
Jealous.
I was like, you know what? We don't have any garbage shows right now. Let's throw on a Below Deck. And it's the newest Below Deck Mediterranean that just
ended.
Yeah. And it starts off with the guy and it's like his best friend dies. He didn't have his documents. And then Sandy is like, I think you committed fraud on your documents.
Oh my
and the
God,
whole time
it's
we're
so good.
It's so juicy. And the whole time we're just like, dude, go home.
Like, how did you think you were going to get away with that?
Well, because he's probably worked on junky boats. He was like, I loved that he didn't fight back. He was just like, I've been on boats for 3 years with that documentation. It's like, yeah, you've been on shady shit. You tried
I'm
to get
on
television. A TV show with a 100,000 ton boat.
Which makes me think
boat.
It was fake because it would have been vetted. Like, they're like, oh, this sounds juicy.
I don't know that they probably did a background check, but it's not their job to do that kind of check. That's the yacht.
It should be.
So maybe. I think they, oh, I or they knew and they're like, oh, baby,
this is going to be juicy.
So at this point, this was the highest elevation any of the remaining climbers had ever been. Wanting to get to the top and not deal with additional weight, the final four left their supplies at Camp 3. They only had what was on them, which was a light pack, jackets, glasses, crampons, Janet's camera, and their ice picks. So this group tried their damnedest, but it seemed with each step they took, the glacier that stood before them only grew taller and further away. They called it a day at 21,000 feet. Without their sleeping bags or tents, the team had to use their axes to make an ice cave to sleep in. Before dawn, Janet and Bill would be fed up with the crowdedness of the cave and chose to instead stick it out in the elements. One of those elements was wind. It was blowing snow around, and that morning, Janet saw that John's legs had been buried in powder.
Oh.
This was the last straw for the man who had already been ready to go home 3 camps ago. He was a skilled climber, so when he made it clear that he would be making the 2-hour hike back to Camp 3 alone, the 3 remaining were like, okay, bye. They were too close to the summit to worry about walking this guy they just met all the way back to camp. Besides, he was just cold and miserable. He hadn't shown any signs of cognitive or physical issues. He was going to be fine. That day, the team of 3 were able to make it to the final ridge, the last piece of mountain separating them from the actual summit. At this point, there wasn't much that was going to stop these men from reaching the top. even with snow that was so deep, it was up to their waist. So they had to alternate taking turns, taking 25 steps to try to create a path.
Wow.
The difficulty and impending darkness would not stop them. Bill and Arnold were so focused on completing the task at hand that they hadn't realized Janet was not with them. Calling out, they had no luck. Walking down toward where she had been, they found her ice axe. Continuing to call, they heard a voice. According to reports later given to authorities, Arnold said he heard, "My name's Janet Johnson." Following the voice, they quickly found Janet as she was only 100 or so feet off the trail. Approaching her, Arnold claimed she said, "Don't make me suffer, just let me lay here and die." At that point, Bill tied himself to Janet, stood her up, and walked her by her arm. It was already getting dark, and by then the men had lost their trail in the search for her. Maybe he was fed up with Janet, maybe he was fed up with everything, but Arnold then went further down the mountain where he could sleep alone. As the sun illuminated their dire situation, it was clear Janet was in real trouble. Her hands were showing signs of frostbite. Arnold rejoined the group, and the two men used their ropes and tools to create a human raft to carry Janet down the mountain. They were making progress, getting to their previously used snow cave by 7 a.m. Inside were a few supplies. Most important was a flare gun, which was fired, but it was of no use in the isolation of the Andes. Perhaps the decreasing elevation was helping Janet because she appeared to be doing better. Able to walk with only Bill, Arnold decided it would be faster if he went on his own to try to get help. Bill agreed, and Arnold was on his way. At one point, he took the express route. Falling on the glacier, he lost his axe and got a black eye, which is pretty amazing that that's all that happened after sliding 1,000 feet down a mountain face first. As he got further down, he realized help was already on the way. He could hear his name being called. He saw military personnel. Sadly, he also saw dead mules and a dead soldier. But why would there be a dead soldier in the snow on this random mountain? As Bill carried Janet, he saw things as well, like construction vehicles working on the mountain. He strained to listen as he believed he could hear rescuers calling out for them. That pair also fell down the mountain a bit. They were okay, but broke their glasses and had some slight abrasions on their faces. Looking up after the fall, Bill could see the tents of the camp. They were getting close. But they were also now separated. The fall had untied Bill and Janet from each other. Somehow, he found the strength to not only get up, but to start walking back up the mountain in an effort to locate Janet. He found her, and she was all right. She needed a moment to catch her breath, but she said she'd be ready to continue going downhill. Bill then saw the same figure Arnold had taken as a dead soldier. It wasn't a soldier. It was John from NASA. He never made it back to Camp 3. From best Bill could tell, as a police officer who probably had some experience with death, it appeared John died from either hypothermia, exhaustion, or a combination of both. There were no apparent injuries that would have implied a fall or foul play. Because Janet was doing all right, she was okay with Bill going ahead of her to get to Camp 3, where he could get a tent set up. This stretch was expected to take a couple of hours to complete. When Bill arrived at Camp 3, it was only a few hours after Arnold had gotten there. Worn out, they set up their camp and went to sleep. It wasn't until the following morning they realized that Janet never showed.
It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself. So Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out.
Politics aside, being a woman is hard. When it comes to our ever-changing menstrual cycle, perimenopause, or menopause, we could use support. And that's where Happy Mammoth comes in. Remember that awful week before your period where you feel off and look in the mirror and don't recognize your reflection and you want to crawl out of your own skin? I don't. Estro Control by Happy Mammoth has made managing PMS symptoms so much easier. And for my friends who are going through menopause or perimenopause, or even if you've come out the other side and still feel like a wet sock on a busy highway, Hormone Harmony is a lifesaver. It's not just me saying this, it's become a phenomenon. Women can't stop talking about it on social media, and a bottle is sold every 24 seconds. The secret? Happy Mammoth uses only science-backed ingredients, including adaptogens, which help your body adapt to the stressors of hormonal changes. It's not just for menopause either. Any woman with hormonal imbalances can benefit. Imagine getting relief from hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, and poor sleep. And the best part, feeling like yourself again. With over 17,000 reviews, this isn't just hype. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code RAIN for 15% off.
By then, the two men were not only exhausted, but they had been suffering from hallucinations and other side effects of elevation sickness. They didn't want to get lost, even more sick, or injured, so they headed down the mountain. Everyone who had already turned back ran up to meet them and was shocked to see only two of the four mountaineers return. The men told the group, "Janet and John are dead." This is where the story takes a strange turn. On the surface, and even without mountain climbing experience, you could say, well, John was under snow and was probably hypothermic, so as he went down the mountain, he simply succumbed to his symptoms. As for Janet, she had fallen, been in the snow, and appeared to be suffering from a multitude of issues. She, too, may have been hallucinating and taken a wrong step into a crevasse or simply wound up in the snow, another victim of hypothermia. Because of the distance and language barriers, the story of the eight Americans who went to Argentina to climb a mountain and only six were returning quickly swirled and brewed into tales of misinformation, confusion, and myths. Even though his body had been located, John was, in his hometown paper, reported to have fallen into a deep crevasse during a blinding snowstorm. The U.S. Embassy of Buenos Aires even had to get involved, releasing the statement, "Deaths did not occur as a result of a fall as reported by United Press International and Associated Press, or as the result of an avalanche as reported by Reuters." The stories were so confusing and unlike anything seen with normal climbing deaths, not to mention being a story of Americans who had already been celebrated in the news and then a homicide investigation was opened. Whatever newspaper or agency or country, everyone seemed to agree that all of the details needed to be sorted out before coming to any kind of conclusion. The remaining climbers were all interviewed as part of the investigation. It was clear they were still shaken by everything they had gone through. It was also difficult, because of the altitude sickness, to decipher what had really been seen or heard by the climbers and what had just been a hallucination. It doesn't look good to a homicide investigator to not be able to tell a straight story. Adding to the bad optics, Carmi Defoe, the leader of the group, was also a lawyer, and all he cared about was keeping the press from questioning the climbers as they prepared to leave the country. So imagine if a group of people from Argentina had come to the States, climbed a mountain, two of them died, and then they did not speak publicly because of their lawyer? I think that would have a lot of people concerned about what actually happened. Back here in Portland, there was an emergency and secret meeting of some of the members of the Mazamas Club. How secret was it? Well, in all caps, part of the memo read, "None but the above named shall be allowed to attend. The location was to be kept secret. Repeat, secret." On February 15th, those invited met at Carmi's office. It was the leaders of the club and the remaining climbers. They were going to get one concise, clear account of the climb and all of the events that took place. In the end, they decided both Janet and John probably died of pulmonary edema, a condition that can be caused by high elevations that leads to fluid filling the lungs. Without their bodies, funerals were held for both John and Janet in March and April. Janet's family didn't ask for her body to be returned if it had been found. They knew that should something happen, she had wanted to be buried in the Trailhead Cemetery. Finding the bodies was of utmost importance. With the bodies, you have answers as to a cause of death and can close a painful chapter of this ill-fated trip. At the end of 1973, as the summer was coming back around, a four-man team was sent to search for them. Alfonso was the team leader as a way to make up for not being able to be a true leader on the original climb. They took with them two toboggans. They would be, with sheet metal on the bottom, makeshift gurneys if they did find a body. One of the sleds would be put to use a week later when, at the bottom of the glacier and just 300 or so feet from their camp, they found John's body. He was frozen solid. Around him were torn-up tents and sleeping bags. Because Lauren McIntyre, a National Geographic reporter and photographer, had joined the recovery expedition, there is a picture of John's stiff body on the sled. From afar, you can't tell that he isn't just resting. That position was how they had found him, flat on the ground, legs out and crossed at the ankles. His jacket was on, but his hood wasn't, neither were his gloves, so his bare hands laid across his stomach. With vicious weather, the tiny sled, the large frozen statue of a man, getting him loaded to go down the mountain was nearly impossible. Instead of getting him all the way down that day, they left him, safely restraining him in place, and went back the following day to get him. Knowing this story was a worldwide phenomenon, Lauren McIntyre, the photojournalist, was first to get back to John's body the next day. He carefully documented John's equipment, possessions, and body. He knew these would be pertinent to the investigation. In John's personal effects, Lauren found a letter from his wife. It read, "Keep roped up and don't forget the crampons, as I don't know how I'd replace you. You are by far the best husband and loving one and really good dad in the entire world." Other important details from where John was found. He was lying on a gentle slope. He no longer had his ice axe. He was missing one crampon. His face was beaten and frozen in permanent terror. Most shockingly, once John's body thawed, a large circular hole was found on his stomach where his hands had been covering. Now, here's a detail that might make you say, "Ooh, something fishy happened," or "Doesn't that show just how much elevation can affect your mind?" Bill had told Alfonso after the initial climb that he had found John not only sitting up, but with his face in his hands. For some, this solidified something nefarious had occurred. For others, it appeared John had perhaps fallen on his ice axe, hard enough to not only penetrate his body, but to get through several thick layers of clothing. He then sat down and took off his gloves to deal with the injury before falling over dead. Once he was found and an autopsy was conducted, John Cooper was laid to rest in the Sunset Lawn Cemetery in Kansas. Oddly, the entire autopsy was sealed by a judge. He did release the front page to the public, though. It stated the cause of death was not the possible axe injury or even hypothermia. It was found the cause of death was cranial contusions. That didn't immediately clear up anything. Head injuries could have come from a fall. The hole in his abdomen was perfectly round and went all the way through to his spine, though. This left at least one member of the medical team who processed his body thinking that it had been caused by an ice screw. It wouldn't be until February 1975 that Janet's body would be found. 17-year-old Alberto Colombero, along with his father and another friend, were out climbing the mountain, a mountain that they had traveled many times. Wanting to escape an oncoming storm, also ditching getting to the summit, the group decided to go down the Polish route. They didn't need to talk about it. The local legend had Janet's body at the forefront of their minds. Amazingly, as they descended, Alberto spotted something red. He wasn't sure what to make of it at first, but they weren't going to let Snow or those pesky penitents keep them from investigating. Attempting to dig out the tattered tent or backpack they thought it might have been, they soon revealed the face of Janet Johnson. She was blackened from frostbite, possible sun exposure, and whatever mummification could have taken place in those cold conditions. Unlike John, they saw the physical damage to Janet's face immediately. She had bloodstains on her face and coat. Bone was jutting out from her forehead, chin, and nose. Her chin skin hung off of her face. She had ropes around her, which made sense given how she and Bill were coming down the mountain. Just like John, she was missing a single crampon and her ice axe. Like John, she wasn't wearing her gloves. Given the slope of where she was found, the experienced climbers found it impossible to believe that this is where she and Bill had fell, or even a place that she had fallen on her own. On her body or face, even in this article, the details are conflicting, there was a rock, the size of which you could hold in your hand, and it appeared almost to have been placed on her. She was surrounded by and buried under snow. Even 2 years prior, there wouldn't have been rocks in that area, leaving some to say it had been placed on her or used as a weapon. Others say she was on a mountain and she fell. Rocks are part of the deal. Since they hadn't planned on recovering a body that day, the men left Janet there, being sure to mark the area for future searchers. They were able to take off the ring she had purchased for herself while in New Mexico, and they sent it home to her sister Judy. For reasons unknown, it took a year to get a team back to the mountain to retrieve Janet. She was now much more mummified because the men had left her exposed for recovery. After a search revealed no other personal items were in the area, they began the removal. By that time, Janet and the glacier had become one. She was frozen solid to the ice, so much so that they actually had to cut off her left arm at the shoulder. It was the only way to get the rest of her down. An autopsy was conducted by the same team that did John's. They documented how broken Janet's face was and that she had notably deep cuts on one of her boots. In the end, she too was documented as dying from head injuries. All of the autopsy team members were convinced that these deaths were homicides. Soon after, she was laid to rest, as she wanted, at the cemetery at the bottom of the mountain. Then, just as the investigation and public curiosity were coming to a head, the entire investigation was pushed to the back burner. Long and short of it, Henry Kissinger, rest in hell, basically overthrew the government of Argentina via a military coup, leading to tens of thousands of deaths and 7 years of unrest. The concern about the American climbers was no longer. For the next 50 years, there were only rumors, myths, and legends when it came to the Americans who tried to summit Acahuanga. There were tales of a backpack that had been filled with all of the money for the trip, which had never been recovered. People are murdered for money all the time. Then there was the hilarious idea that Janet and one of the men were having a love affair and another man got jealous. You know, because a woman can't just be climbing a mountain. She must have been causing some romantic trouble. Maybe she was upset she hadn't been able to complete the summit, so she walked off in the night, motivated by delusions brought on by the elevation. One more realistic option, she started walking down to meet at the camp and simply lost her footing and fell. But experts from morticians to climbers all agree that the injuries she sustained just are not consistent with a fall. As Raphael Moran, the original reporter of the story, says, if you looked at this as a storyteller, you could easily say these were murders or these were accidents. But for him, looking at journalistic standards, it's simply impossible to come to any conclusion. Carmi Defoe died in 1975 in a car crash. Bill died in 2003 and Arnold in 2011. John Shelton, as the only living survivor of the climbing team, spoke to the New York Times before passing last November. He said it's all nonsense. Accidents happen on mountains. The end. There's nothing more to it, and the only thing adding to it is curiosity and stories. He has seen too many falsehoods reported to be concerned with it being anything more than that. One of the biggest hmms comes from a climbing expert who has seen many falls. When they happen, it is not just the person who's torn up. It's their clothes, equipment, their bones. They are battered. Why is it that these two would only have trauma to their faces and a hole in the abdomen? The reason there is renewed interest in this story is because of a discovery made in February 2020. Because of climate change, the glacier on the Polish route is shrinking. So as the sun shined and two guides prepared for a climb, something caught their eye. It was an old Nikon camera with a leather strap and a broken lens. Pulling it from the snow and turning it over, they saw the labels on the bottom that had Janet's name and address. There were hopes, but people were realistic. You know, could the film possibly be developed after 50 years sitting inside a glacier? And even if the film could be developed, would there be photos that showed anything that would close this chapter? Incredibly, amazingly, unbelievably, the film was developed.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I'm like, I get worried about something being out in the yard for a day. This camera was in a glacier for half a century.
Good camera right there. Right? They should put that on their
An ad for Nikon. The photos are stunning. Again, you've got to go check out this article and you'll see the actual photos that were developed from that film. And they talk in detail about the process of developing the film and how scary it was because they knew that any wrong move could have damaged it.
You don't want to be the asshole that
ruined exactly. It. Like, we got the camera and I turned on a light. Sorry. The photos are of stunning peaks, trains of climbers making their way up, Janet wearing her pack, and a shot of just how close they got to the summit. There's beauty not just in the photo's subject, but in the streaky, nearly neon blotches that ended up on them because of the water. It looks like someone went to Goodwill and bought a bunch of old photos and then threw some paint over them with neon greens and blues, like 1980s ghosts. They're really beautiful. The photos didn't show a murder taking place or anyone being aggressive or scared. They showed people doing what they loved to do. They show Janet with a smile as she is in the happiest place she could possibly be. The story of the Akawanga climbers may never be solved. And like the Winchester House in California, it seems that the story will continue to be built upon for the rest of time. So I have a couple bullet points. One, along with the camera, they did also find and recover her left arm, also left in the ice. So one question I would have would be about the autopsy. So I don't know what Argentina was like in the 1970s or what their equipment or education was. I mean, here in the States, we barely have licensure for some of our people that work in mortuaries or our coroners. So who knows? Maybe they were more strict, maybe more lax. I think that would be helpful to know kind of where that stood back then.
And it could be, you know, like the U.S. is very different. Some states have coroners right. who aren't as trained as medical examiners who
right.
have to have PhD. So it could be like that, too. I don't know within the country itself if it varies.
So another question is when there is murder, there's usually a motive. The only thing I could think of if I had to decide these were murders would be that since some of the guys were already expressing annoyance with Janet and that she was hell-bent on getting to the summit, that elevation sickness may have caused aggression or hallucinations that led to her being hit with a rock or pushed down a hill. I would have liked to hear if the wounds looked like they came from an ice axe or a rock. Even if that was the case, it doesn't explain John's death because no one was with him. So It doesn't appear he was attacked. We don't know where everyone was as far as their journey back down the mountain. So in that case, the question then becomes, what made the hole in his stomach and what position did he really die? And just like with Janet, why was his face battered, but the rest of him wasn't?
Right. Was there like a fight and somebody died on accident and the other was technically murdered? Like,
yeah,
there's so many things that could have happened.
Are there theories about the weapon that would have been used if it was a murder?
There wasn't anything mentioned in the article. And so that leaves me wondering, because there is also the theory that as Janet was crying out, you know, just leave me here to die, that kind of thing, that. Again, with the hallucinations and the frustration and everything going on, did one of the guys take a rock and put her out of her misery? Mm. You know, if she's in pain and crying right. out and can't walk down the mountain.
And did they tell anyone they did that?
Right. So, yeah, they didn't go into detail to say, yeah, it looked like an ice axe that had caused major fractures or a rock that, you know, did more of a smashing type shape.
Those stalagmite things, what were those called?
Penitence.
How pointy are those at the top? Or is that like stabby?
Oh.
Could you fall
Ooh,
on
could
one?
It be one of those
or a rock that was sharp?
Icicle murders, the
yeah,
weapon
exactly.
disappears.
Oh, that's a really good theory. Like if there was a shorter one and he slipped and fell. Yeah, yeah, that's actually a great theory. Yeah, I don't know if there were any in that exact area. Based on what they were described as, I don't think that that's an impossible idea.
You could also fall on your ice axe if you had it out.
Now, sure. That's the other thing they said about him, but yeah. His ice axe was found, like, totally separate. So that was also strange. And then the other thing is Arnold fell and he slid 1,000 feet down the mountain.
Wow.
And he stood up and was fine. You know, he had a black eye.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're all in that same area and they fell in the same place, why would it just be your face?
Well,
and head,
you know,
were
the side of a mountain varies a few feet.
Oh, for
from
sure.
Each other.
But and I think the thing that keeps me questioning is their condition, because it's true. You hear, like, if someone's going to fall so hard that their head is seriously damaged and fractured, how is your shirt or your jacket not ripped up? So yeah, I was so sucked into that article. It was a fascinating read. And there are just so many elements. And again, you know, Josh, you were saying sometimes these people that challenge themselves to things like this, they don't think about those other aspects. So they didn't worry about, oh, why don't we at least spend some time together so we build some camaraderie? Or, you know, is everyone up to skill to be able to do this, instead of, oh, yeah, hey, you guys want to do this? We got it. Cool.
Yeah. A group of hotshots mm-hmm. is not going to be super successful, I think, if everyone's trying to, well.
Out hotshot.
Out hotshot. You can't out hotshot a hotshot. Hotshot.
That's right. It was very fascinating. I'm so glad I got to share it with you guys. It was so interesting to have, you know, 3 people from Oregon, 4 people from Portland area that were part of this. And they were interviewed a bunch. Their stories kind of changed. But again, you can say, yeah, elevation sickness. They thought they saw construction equipment and animals and armies. So
I think I might have read the article. So I went, there was a phase not too long ago where I was obsessed with mountain bodies.
Mm.
And I read a shit ton of articles about all the mountains where there are bodies remaining on them. So I think I may have come across this because I know the story.
It'd be cool if there'd be some way to get an answer. I don't know what that could even possibly be, because everyone has passed away and
no more cameras left on the side
exactly,
of the mountain.
Exactly. Yeah. Elevation sickness, which sounds terrifying, by the way.
No, I'm not being a little silly Billy about this, but what about, were there any theories?
Yetis?
Cryptozoologically? Yeah. Were there any Yetis or anything like that? That was,
I didn't see anything mentioned. I would have to guess, because you can have literally anything happen and someone will say it was Bigfoot.
It was Bigfoot. Yeah.
My car was stolen. Have you looked into Bigfoot? So I would not be surprised if there were not rampant speculations in that regard.
What was the mountain range? Is this the Andes?
Mm-hmm.
Another good story on the Andes. Yep.
Yeah, the Andes, man. They'll get you. And what a great candy.
Andy's Mint. I want one now.
We always got one at my favorite Mexican restaurant as a kid. They brought the bill. Oh boy, couldn't wait for that bill, because you know why? Everyone got an Andy's Mint.
That same at Olive Garden, and I always eat them all.
Oh, so good.
Until Chloe came along and ruined things.
David Duchovny. Did I say
that? Ooh, I love me some David Duchovny. I was just talking about Red Shoe Diaries this morning.
Oh, yeah. Oh, speaking of things that we both have in common, I watched a lot of Red Shoe Diaries.
So did I. Do you remember the episode, You Make Me Want to Wear Dresses?
No.
You make me want to wear dresses. It's about a cowgirl who falls for a guy. And there's this scene where she's in a bath and that song's playing and she's getting all cleaned up and she's going to wear a dress and go hit on him.
Is that a real song?
If for
or
the
is it
show,
a red, it's a Red Shoe Diary.
Red Shoe Diary song. There is a song called You Make Me Want to Wear Dresses, but it's not the same. I already looked it up this morning. Because she never watched that show with me, but she heard me talk about it so frequently that she knows how the song goes.
Are you still on TikTok Live?
No.
Oh, I was going to say.
It's Patreon time. I'm absolutely off TikTok Live.
If you could ask people for a good source of Red Shoe Diaries.
May I go on, or do you have more to say about Alive and or Red Shoe Diaries?
No.
Okay. It's okay if you do.
Wait,
maybe there'll be a crossover episode?
Ooh. I'm so cold. Come keep me warm.
Wait, I think there was a sex scene in that, wasn't there?
In Alive?
Or a romantic scene? I don't remember.
There's a lot horny of like cuddling because of the cold.
Oh, that could be. I'm confusing cuddling.
She's like, wow, they are intimate.
Yeah, like 3-man sleeping bag action.
Oh, that's what I'm talking
about.
There
was a wife and husband on there, but they didn't. She was dying, so they weren't.
Yeah. She was and then did.
And got eaten.
I'd try it. I'd be like, let's keep me warm, baby. Let's jumble our bodies around a little.
But you don't want to lose your calories, man. You don't want to work those off.
Mm. Well, I'm no expert. I didn't watch Alive 100 times.
Yeah, I did.
The Polish glacier.
Nice mazamas.
Thank you. 45, a fusician.
Ooh, I've always wanted to hear someone play the fuse. They just take him out of a car and they're like, tink, 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 tink.
Nickelodeon.
Tinky, tink.
Right? That's what you just did. This was at the base of what is known as the Polish Glacier.
You got a lot of hard words today.
Oh, I know. Rural juror.
Reuters.
Wanting to escape an oncoming storm. Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderintherain. And suck my balls.